What quality of music are you going to get? When people have to work day jobs, you know, the whole phenomenon of being poor and famous. You know, I don't know if that's going to work.
Our sister Natalie, someone asked her, what's your perfect day? And she says, I would wake up in London, I would go to Borough Market, and I would play at Royal Albert Hall that night. And then, seriously, two days later, James Bay texts us and is like, what do you think about this? And we're like, holy crap.
Because you're altering the DNA of everything you've been listening to, altering it, bringing it up to date, modifying it, and turning it into a kind of higher art form.
That trips me out more than any accolade, than winning any Grammy, than any of that shit. That's how you win.
I think I just really completely unhooked myself from the sort of rat race that you can get caught in with music. So I just was like, why would I do this unless I do exactly what I want?
I was nowhere. You know, I'd lost my record deal, massively in debt, and no obvious signs that I would ever be able to recover that, you know, because a career looked to be pretty much finished.
There is no formula to having a hit record. It happens, and it's probably 60% luck, 30% talent, and 10% timing.
Making a hit record is tough, but maintaining success is another skill entirely. On The Art of Longevity, we explore the artist's experience of the music business from the inside. I want to find out what separates those artists and bands that have survived decades in the music business from all those who've fallen by the wayside. We follow a narrative inspired by a quote from Brett Anderson of Suede, who said that all successful artists have followed a similar career arc, like stations of the cross. The struggle, success, excess, disintegration, and if you're lucky, enlightenment. With insights and stories for music fans, aspiring musicians, and creators, this is The Art of Longevity. The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand.
Martin Courtney of Real Estate, welcome to The Art of Longevity. How are you, Martin, and whereabouts in the world are you?
Hello. I'm well. I'm home, which is in the Hudson Valley, just north of New York City.
You're soon to be over here in the UK, aren't you?
Very briefly, for like a day. My bandmate and I are coming over to do some press and some an in-store, maybe a couple in-stores. Yeah, like it's kind of a whirlwind because we're only in London for a day and then a couple other cities and then home.
I guess this is partly the reality of touring as a US band these days coming to Europe. It's like, you know, let's scale it down a little bit because otherwise it's getting harder, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is like a proper like press trip, which we're lucky to have. You know, we're on a UK-based label, Domino. So they have, I think, more invested in us wanting to come over there and, you know, wanting us to kind of show face. I think maybe US labels, I don't know, that just from what I hear, like this is not that common for American bands to get like flown out to Europe to do press. So I feel lucky in that regard, but it doesn't replace like an actual tour where we, you know, play clubs with the full band. And like, so, you know, I think we're still trying to piece that together potentially for later this year. But yeah, you know, everything's just more expensive now. So it's hard to make stuff work.
Yeah. Have you done an in-store at Rough Trade before?
Yeah, I think we did one with the full band like years ago. We've definitely done at least one, maybe more than one, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice intimate affair. It's really relaxed and it's great to sort of have it there in the store and, you know, people are buying your record and all that. It's a good vibe. I will hope to be there, so I look forward to seeing you. Before we get into the thick of it, as it were, you mentioned, you know, you're lucky to come over and do press for the new record, Daniel, which we'll come onto in a minute. I wanted to just get into something topical with you, Martin, because last week in the industry, the news about Pitchfork, you know, was all over, and the fact that, you know, Pitchfork is now being folded into, you know, a couple of columns and review section in Gentleman's Quarterly magazine. I mean, Pitchfork was let's say, central to your early success? You know, you had a couple of legendary 8.5 reviews for your first couple of records. I mean, how has the news gone down with you as a band?
I mean, it's alarming, you know? I mean, it's easy to feel kind of snarky about Pitchfork. You know, obviously we are indebted to them. They gave our first three records best new music, and they've always been relatively kind to our other stuff, you know, even the ones that they didn't give like glowing reviews to. We've never gotten panned. So I think with any artist, there's always kind of a love-hate relationship with any critical outlet. But I mean, beyond the whatever personal feelings we may have towards them, which are mostly positive, to be honest, you vacillate between feeling like they have too much influence and feeling like they are completely irrelevant now, you know, and which is, but that's neither here nor there. I mean, it's a bummer to see like the continuing shrinkage of the music industry and like, you know, indie music is, it feels kind of scary. I mean, we see it from our end, like, you know, it's harder and harder to make, you know, good money doing music. And so then seeing it on the other end as well with the, you know, the critical end, and just seeing, you know, the personal end of like people who have dedicated their lives to caring about music, you know, like professional fans, you know, like I think critics, it's, they have to care more about music than musicians, I think sometimes, you know, like it's hard for me to get excited about music sometimes, you know, other than my own. And even then it's like, sometimes I need to really like kick myself in the ass to like, you know, I got to write a song, you know, I got to write some music. And then, you know, and then I get excited as I'm writing, but it's like, if it's your job to like be constantly discovering new music and keeping on top of it, like that's a whole nother level of dedication that I certainly don't have. So I respect that. So yeah, it's a bummer. It's a bummer to see that kind of devalued for sure. But it's also, yeah, it's kind of like, it's sadly feels inevitable, and it's all rolled into like the rise of streaming and you know, people getting their taste from an algorithm rather than, you know, it's like true taste makers are kind of few and far between now.
First of all, you're right. It was a place where music lovers essentially, you know, gathered to write and read. And it was a celebration of music in that respect. Like journalism and the kind of 8.5 reviews to one side, that's where you went if you love music. And there will be other destinations for that. But it seems like they're, you know, kind of scattered to the ends of the earth. It's getting harder and harder to find them. I mean, as a band, what would you consider good press these days? Or when you're putting a record out like you're about to do, what do you wish for in terms of good press? Or do you just not even think about that now?
Yeah, it's this thing where like I want to, you know, like I would wish for like a cool feature in some publication that might introduce us to a new audience, you know, like honestly, like if Pitchfork wrote a feature on us, it probably wouldn't count for much. But if like the New Yorker or something, you know, someone said something that didn't just cater to our core indie rock base, you know, that's the kind of stuff that you hope for. At the same time, I kind of know that no amount of press is going to count as much as like getting on some really good Spotify playlists, you know, like honestly, it's like, that's what's going to put you in front of people. And that's what's going to get people excited about your song and buy tickets to your show, you know? And that's like the main thing is like, we just need to sell tickets because, you know, it's hard to make money any other way. So it's like, yeah, just trying to get your music in front of people any way you can and grow your base, but like, or grow your fan base or something. But I mean, it's stuff like this too. Like to me, like what I want now, it's like, I like the idea of like a cool press, a cool like print feature, just because it's like, it looks cool and it's just like, feels good to like see your picture on a magazine or I don't know, like that stuff is like, it strokes the ego. But like, I also really, I actually have been doing a lot of these like podcast thing interviews. And like, obviously I listen to a ton of podcasts, and I think actually that's probably can be more influential than anything else as well. I don't know.
Okay. So let's talk about Daniel a bit. So I was excited anyway, when I heard the news of a real estate record coming, and then I found out it was, you worked with Daniel Tashian on this record as well. He's one of my favorite producers. So now I'm even more excited about it. So tell me first just how that partnership came about.
Well, I mean, I guess I was first introduced to his work as a producer through, you know, my kids. I have three daughters, and I guess the oldest one heard Casey Musgraves' record, Golden Hour, and that became like, it's kind of, it's, you know, my kids, sometimes they like good music, and sometimes, a lot of times they, you know, they listen to like Disney soundtracks or whatever, stuff that like does nothing for me.
Tell me about it. I have three girls as well. So, and I think mine are older than yours. So yeah, it just keeps, you have to get into their music eventually. You just have to surrender. Yeah.
So it's nice. Yeah. It's like, it's nice when it's something, cause I'll find myself listening to like, I don't know, like the, some Disney soundtrack being like, finding things about it that I like. And then I'm like, God, what is happening to me? Like, I'll be like, actually, this song's pretty good. So yeah, I guess I can get into anything. But yeah, I mean, the Casey Musgraves record, I was like, oh, this is like great. You know, it's like so well constructed, and the songs are so like, they're just great songs, and the production is really interesting. And so whatever. So like, I kind of talked about that a lot, to, you know, to my bandmates, just being like, this record's really good. And I guess at a certain point, I probably mentioned it to the label too, or our guy Chris at Domino. So then once we started talking about, I kind of had this specific idea for what I wanted to do with this new record. And I really wanted to make, like, I wrote a couple songs that felt really like these little concise pop songs. And I was like, this feels like a really fun direction. Like, I want to explore this. And, you know, we've always had on our records, like, a mix of like, there's been a couple like kind of shorter pop songs, and then some more like psychedelic kind of more like whatever meandering type songs, jammier songs. So I was like, what if we just did that? You know, what if we just made a pop record? And that felt really exciting to me. And so then I guess I mentioned that to Domino, and they were like, well, you talked about that Musgraves record, you know, Daniel Tashian is the producer. And I guess I hadn't really thought to look up the credits. So kind of came from the label, the idea of working with him. And, you know, it was like him and a few other people we were talking about. And I just kept coming back to, I really liked the idea of working with him because he's a songwriter himself, you know, and I like his style of songwriting. And I like the idea of, we hadn't really worked with a producer. I hadn't really allowed myself to want to open up my songwriting process to a producer in the past. It had always been kind of like, just make it sound good. You know, maybe they'll have some ideas here or there about whatever sounds, things we can do with. And this was the first time where I was like, I am interested in seeing how opening up the songwriting to someone whose style I respect, how that could improve my songs. And really what I wanted was to see how much I could take away, like see how concise I could make these songs and like how much I could strip out of them and like have it be just this core nugget of an idea. So that's kind of what I wanted from Daniel. And that's how we ended up working with it.
I mean, first of all, yeah, I agree that the Golden Hour record, the Casey Musgraves record, that, because he co-wrote some of the songs with Casey on that, right? So did he co-write with you on this? Would you go that far? Or?
He doesn't have like co-writing credits. No, I pretty much wrote all the songs and then sent him demos. And honestly, he didn't really have any input until we were in the studio. And then, you know, we would go, you know, going song by song, and at the beginning of each song, you know, like we'd finish one, move on to the next, and I would play it for him on acoustic guitar. You know, I'd sit there and he'd listen and kind of chart the song out and then be like, that was really great. And sometimes he'd have nothing. And sometimes he'd be like, I really like this section. You know, what if this chord seems superfluous? So, you know, like things like that. Like, what if, you know, he'd have these little things, and then we'd kind of relearn, you know, every idea that he had, we at least wanted to try, because we're like, this is why we're here. We're working with this guy. But yeah, it was with the kind of the shaping of the structure of the songs. And then he, you know, obviously has he's got a great ear for melody. So he would kind of come up with these little things here and there, like, you know, a little background vocal. He'd be like, oh, what if I'm hearing this little thing? And then I'd go in and sing it, and, you know, and we'd be like, oh yeah, that sounds great. And so stuff like that.
The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. Bowers & Wilkins makes some of the world's finest audio products, from the iconic 800 series loudspeakers, trusted by Abbey Road Studios for over 40 years, to the flagship PX8 wireless headphones. This is music as the artist intended you to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, he does have a signature sound in a way as a producer. You know, there's something about it. It's very clean and crisp, but it's not clinical. It has a warmth to it as well. And I was listening back to it thinking, well, how much of that is going to come across on the record? Because he's rare in that sense, is when you kind of hear a record, you can almost hear that it's him who's made it, if you know who he is. But it is quite subtle. But certainly in tracks like Flowers, that for me just sounds like, wow, there's a Daniel Taschen influence on that song and a couple of others as well, of course.
It's funny because that is one where he really didn't have much to say. You know, I mean, that one, if anything... There's this one chord change at the end of the chorus of that song where it goes to an F, like it's like, and it kind of sticks out. And I like it because I don't know why. I like it. I like the way the melody kind of plays with that chord. He like hated that. Like he kept being like, why are we playing this F? Like, why is this in here? I'm like, I don't know. I just like it. He's like, yeah, no, he definitely had a lighter touch than I thought he was going to. And to be honest, I mean, in terms of like his input to the actual content of the music, it was. To me, like his main contribution was just he's so fun in the studio and really like he's like a cheerleader. I mean, like you're looking through the glass to the control room and he's like jumping around, you know, like trying to hype you up. Like he's just like a fun guy to have around, you know, and he made us kind of get excited to make a record. You know, it's like it's nice to have that because it can be daunting being in the studio.
Well, it'd be nice as well, wouldn't it, if some of that commercial gold of Golden Hour would rub off on the record somehow as well.
That'd be nice. Yeah, I'm like, well, this guy won Album of the Year. And the guy that mixed the record, Craig Alvin, like, I mean, the album sounds, to me, like, the sound of the album, like, I had nothing to do with how good it sounds, so I can brag and say, like, it's like an incredible sounding record, I think, our album. But yeah, that guy won some Grammys too. I'm just like, we've got like, you know, high-powered people in this room. I mean, that was to me like, to be honest, like we hadn't made a record in a while and things had gotten pretty weird with COVID and like not touring and it just felt like bad, you know? And so I was like, I wasn't even sure if we were going to make another album. And then it was like, all of a sudden it's like, Daniel Taschen is interested in working with you and like, we are going to work in this like legendary studio in Nashville. And like all these things started lining up. And I was like, that gave me a lot of confidence to be like, I guess, I don't know. It's easy to get for me to get down on myself and to be like, you know, what makes me more special than, you know, any other person that's trying to, you know, making music. And, you know, I've had some success, you know, it hasn't been like anything incredible, but I've been very lucky, very fortunate. And like, I still struggle with this all the time, but to have that, you know, to have like that vote of confidence from somebody who has like really done well for themselves and obviously is extremely talented felt really good, you know, to have him being like, these songs are great. You know, like I'm excited to make this record with you. That felt really good.
Yeah. And, you know, as you say, there's something about the idea, especially in this day and age, of making an album of lean pop songs, you know, just 2.5, 3.5 minutes. I think that the only track on the album that goes beyond 5 minutes is the closing track, right? Which it's about right for the feel of a closing song. So I really like that. And in a sense, it's got the elements of a classic record about it. Do you still believe in the idea of the possibility to make a classic album?
I mean, you can make one. Like, I don't know. They don't get received necessarily in that way anymore. I mean, some people, it depends. But no, I mean, that's always been... You know, my goal as a songwriter and like our goal as a band is to make not necessarily classic albums, but to make albums and to, you know, to be thinking about, you know, a batch of songs as like as a whole and, you know, and how they fit together. I definitely had grand ambitions with this album for sure. And my whole thing was like, I was obsessed with Automatic for the People, the REM record. Just because I really love the way that album sounds.
Well, there you go. I mean, you know, a classic that is the perfect manifestation of an album, right? And at that period of their career as well.
Yeah, well, exactly. So, but I mean, it's like, so on a granular level, like, I don't pretend to like be able to write songs like that or whatever. Like, I don't think our songs sound like REM songs, but it was, to me, I was like, I really love how the acousticness of it all, like the acoustic guitar, mandolin, organ, piano, you know, very organic sounding, but not sounding Americana or country. Like, it's, to me, that was like, that was the goal with this record. Like, I didn't want it to sound indie, you know, and I didn't want to have these like signifiers. I didn't want a lot of like delay or, you know, effects on the guitar or on the vocals for that matter. Not a lot of synth. I honestly wanted no synth, but then it kind of crept its way in there in a few tracks. But like, yeah, I wanted it to have that kind of timeless, kind of organic feeling like that record does. It was also kind of nice to think about how like they had been a band for, I don't know, 12 years or something. And then they made this like grand, classic, beautiful record that like, to me, is their, my favorite album of theirs. I know a lot of people prefer the earlier stuff, but like that record is like, that's, I love that album so much. It means so much to me. So it was partially that, just being, we've been doing this for a long time. It's easy to start to feel like, you know, you see it happen with your other, with your favorite bands. Like maybe like you listen to everything that they put out and then one day comes where they put a record out and you're like, you don't get around to listening to it, you know, or like you kind of forget that it's like, even if it's your favorite band, you start to kind of care less. And that's going to happen to everyone, obviously. And so that's another thing that I'm thinking of. I mean, that's like, probably plays into the theme of your podcast, but like, it's definitely weighs heavy on me. And I'm like, so how do we make this? Like, you have to care still. You have to believe that you could make something that is going to resonate with people. And at the very least, you have to believe that you can make something that's, you know, worth making. And like, how do you do that? To me, like this record was like, to make it feel special and to make it feel, you know, beyond the like what the stuff I already mentioned of like working with this really great producer and going to this great studio, but it was like doing that with simple songs and without these grand ambitions for like each individual part of the record. Like it felt like we're going to do something that feels small and personal and like feels easy to us, you know. Like these songs felt like we weren't really trying to prove anything, you know. I was just trying to write the best songs that I could and have fun doing it, and then like the arrangements kind of fell into place, you know. The arrangements kind of, the songs kind of wrote themselves. Yeah,
I think you've achieved it.
Well, thank you.
you just have to get the rest of the world to agree now. You know, and I'll do my bit. You have to get Domino to do their bit. When you know you've made something good, I'll let you into a secret. It's like, if I only have the guests on if the album's good, right? So,
that's great.
If the album's not one of the best, I like, okay, let's do it next time. You know, then you have a desire, right, to get as many people as possible to hear it.
Yeah, and people haven't even heard it yet, you know, and so we've put out two singles. The record comes out next month, and like, we're going on tour. To be completely honest, like, the tour's selling great. Everything's going great. But like, I was like kind of hoping that it was going to like, everything was going to just sell out in the snap of a finger. That's not happening. And that's fine, because people are not used to us being around. You know, we've been kind of away for a while. And so like, people kind of, they forget about you, and that's totally fine. But what my hope is that they'll hear the record and be like, oh, this is like, and it'll resonate with them in the moment. But like, also sometimes things take time. Like the last record we put out, we couldn't tour because it came out right before COVID. And so we didn't get that like experience of sharing it with people. And I was kind of like, everything about that left a weird taste in my mouth, a bad taste in my mouth, to be honest. And like that whole experience was like, then it came out and like, it was like, we were truly attempting to make the best album we've ever made. We spent a year working on that album. It was our fifth album. We'd been a band for 10 years. Like all these round numbers, we're like, we're going to, you know, this is very important. This is an important record. We kept like hammering that into ourselves. And then it came out and like, it felt like it got some okay reviews. And like, I have no idea if anybody even heard it. But then over the years, you know, and because we didn't get to tour and I didn't get to talk to people about it, you know, and like, then it does seem like over the years, like, I have gotten the opportunity to talk to people that like that record means a lot to them, you know? So the hope is that it resonates right away and that, you know.
My take on this is that these types of records, as in potentially what we might call classic albums, you know, with just a batch of great songs. You know, there's just 10, 11 songs. It's a short collection. The whole thing is kind of done and dusted in 40 minutes, you know, is coming back, because in the age we're in where there's a gazillion songs uploaded and songs are sped up and there's clips all over as well as the full thing, is that there's definitely a flight back to, okay, no, we've lost touch of what this was about. This was about making a batch of good songs that you can listen to in a 40-minute session. I think vinyl's part of that. Hopefully your timing is good, but yeah, keep working it. I mean, you've already made a classic album anyway. I mean, I was listening back to your catalog, and Atlas is the one that stands out. And, you know, I'm sure you've talked about that a lot. And I'm interested in your view of where you see that record sitting in the oeuvre now. But it is a classic album. So you've done it before, and you've probably done it again.
Well, thank you. I like a short record. I think you get into 15 songs and then I start to like, just keep it short. You know, I mean, that to me feels like the proper way to make a record. Atlas, like, I also think it might be my favorite too. Like whenever I play solo shows, you know, if I'm playing acoustic guitar and not without a band, like I end up playing a lot of songs from that record because I can. Like a lot of the songs on other albums, kind of, to me at least, they feel like they need the full arrangement to sound right. And, you know, it's something that has taken me a while to realize that I do feel like I've achieved with every song on this new record, is like, it's important to be able to play it by itself, you know, like for it to sound good and be able to stand on its own, for me to just strum it and sing it. And honestly, like what I was saying when we were making this record and I was playing each song for Daniel, you know, I wouldn't have been able to do that on a lot of the previous songs that we've made, because it would be like me playing some weird little riff, you know, that like doesn't sound right without the bass. You know, like I used to love to build up these little parts, which I think, you know, contributed to our sound. But I what I realized is like you can still do that while also having like a very solid song underneath. And anyway, so yeah, that for some reason, like, there's a lot of songs on Atlas that feel good to play live by myself. So like, A, you know, in some way, I just feel like subconsciously, like, you know, that means that's a good record or something. I mean, it was like the first record we made was us in our parents' basements, just like recording on a 4-track and demoing songs, basically. And we didn't really, we weren't making an album. We were just having fun. And then all of a sudden we put those songs together when it seemed like there was some interest in us putting a record out. We just took everything we had made up to that point and put it on a record, called it an album. The second album, we went into the studio, Days. That was our first time going into a studio, but like we really didn't know what we were doing. And I think that album is really cool. And I think, you know, people seem to really like it, but we were really building it in the studio. We kicked our drummer out right before we made that record. So like I played drums on some of the songs, like our other bandmate played drums on some, like it's very like us just kind of trying our best to make something that felt good. And, you know, I think we achieved something with that record, but it feels like a weirder album. Atlas was the first record where like we spent 9 months, you know, we had been touring a lot. I'd been writing all these songs, and then we spent a ton of time just rehearsing every week. This is like the last time we all lived in the city, in one city together. We were all living in Brooklyn. We would just get together all the time and just like a proper band and just practice. So like by the time we were ready to make that album, we had, I think, like 18 songs that were like totally tight and rehearsed. And like we went into the studio for 2 weeks and just laid it all down real quick. That to me feels like the best way to make a record, you know, and that's, we tried to, in that we did that with the subsequent album as well, but we were in a transitional time. And I think that album is also really good in mind. I think all of our records are good, but it's just like different ways of approaching it. And Atlas just feels like, up until this one, which feels very similar to me, it just felt like the most pure kind of distillation of like, we're a band that is tight, that has these songs that we feel good about. We're like ready to go into the studio and record them. And, there's not a lot of ornamentation. You know, it's like, it sounds like a band playing in a room. And that's really what I like about that record is like, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of production. It's just like, yeah, it's just us, you know, and we just had some good material.
And got into the US and UK album charts and you were all over the radio. So I'm hoping that certainly kind of comes around a little bit again for you with Daniel. Certainly radio play, it's a very radio friendly record.
It seems like it's doing well in the UK on like, you know, like, I don't know. Things feel good for sure.
Thanks for listening to The Art of Longevity. I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. Please take a moment to rate the show, leave a review on Apple Podcasts if that's where you listen, and do spread the word. Also, you can sign up via the Song Sommelier webpage for our newsletter, artwork, and much more. Back to the conversation. You talked a little bit about, well, REM and Automatic for the People. It's well known that you're influenced by the Feelies and Galaxy 500 and bands that kind of came up in the 80s. But I think you're about a decade or maybe more younger than I am. So you must have been very, very young when you were hearing that music. What is it about those bands and those kind of 80s indie bands that you were drawn to?
Well, I heard about both of those bands kind of secondhand. One of the bands that felt like the most influential on this band was Yola Tango. They're still like one of my favorite bands, but I just really loved their sound. And like, I was always trying to emulate, you know, Ira Kaplan's guitar tone, even though like I could not come close, but just their kind of creativity and their arrangements and stuff like that. I really loved their music, but they talked a lot about the Feelies. So then that's kind of how I heard the Feelies. And then I got into them, and also, you know, and then it's like, oh, they are from like 5 minutes away from where I grew up, you know, North Hilden, the Feelies are. And then we got the opportunity to play with them and like all these things. All that stuff was amazing. But just on an influential level, it was just like, yeah, I was probably in my 20s when I, you know, heard the Feelies for the first time. So I was older. And then Galaxy 500. That was one of those things where people started comparing us to Galaxy 500, and I had never listened to them before. And so then I checked them out. It, like, people were like, oh, this band must be really influenced by Galaxy. And so I was like, I should probably listen to them. And I really loved their music. But yeah, and then it's like, you can hear how I probably got all those influences kind of secondhand, you know, through other bands that they influenced. Like, I don't even know, like Built to Spill probably has some Galaxy influences, and they were like a huge, that was like my favorite band in high school. I've saw them a million times. And to me, like, I grew up or like, you know, honed my musical taste on like 90s indie rock, you know, Pavement and Built to Spill and I don't know, whatever else, Elliott Smith and stuff. And then worked my way back, you know, from there.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I mean, if anything, yeah, like, and Yola Tango too, you know, like that's like more 90s kind of to me, like all that stuff. And then I was like, oh, what are these bands influenced by? And went a little deeper.
It's a very rich theme, isn't it, of great indie songwriting. And as you say, just really, really cool sound. And a lot of that didn't come over to the UK. You know, Built to Spill, I remember hearing them for the first time at a bar in San Francisco and thinking, this music is so cool. And I asked the guys at the bar, like, who is this? And I'd never heard of them. There's so many bands like that came up in the US 80s scene, I guess almost as a kick against the electronic stuff that was going on at the time. And it never made it over to the UK. So it's really interesting just sort of checking out what's behind your heritage.
It's interesting. I think our label was probably responsible for Domino for bringing a lot of that stuff over at some point when it did, like in the early 2000s or late 90s, because I think they licensed a lot of Drag City and Matador stuff early on.
Real Estate, as you say, you found that signature sound, melding all those influences together. And it has evolved subtly, but it's very much essentially your sound. But then over time, over the 15, 16 years you've been making music and you're about to release your sixth album, guitar music was well out of fashion for a big period of that, as Spotify came up and it was rap and hip hop and Latin and all of that. But now it's so very back. So I look at bands like Rolling Blackouts, Coastal Fever, Bodega, bands like that just seem to be influenced by Real Estate. So it kind of comes back around. I'm just wondering, what do you think about this sort of movement back to the guitar sound? And do you know any of those bands? Do they ever ask you, you know, for advice? I mean, what do you say to them?
No, nobody talks to us. I don't know any of these people. I mean, we've had, like, you'll go play a show somewhere and some younger band is like, you know, you guys were my favorite band in high school or whatever. And like, you kind of feel old, but also really cool. Cause it's like, I think about this all the time. Like I probably would have been my favorite band in high school. You know, like I would have listened to us at least, you know, like it's totally right there. And so I love that. We've always kind of just been in it. So it's hard for me to like, you know, we'll play shows and somehow like as we were getting popular, maybe it seemed like guitar music was getting less popular. And we, maybe that's what prevented us from becoming even, you know, more popular than we got. And so whatever, it's hard for me to tell, you know, like we're just kind of like in the middle of it or in our own little world, I guess. And I don't really know. Like, I know, like, people really love Big Thief now, and, like, they're a great band, and that's, you know, pretty guitar-y, but a little more, like they're very, like, Neil Young-y, I think, I guess. Like, that's what it reminds me of, which I love. But, yeah, no, I mean, I'm definitely aware of the fact that, like, we have been influential.
I'll tell you what we should do, because we talked about Pitchfork. There's a magazine called So Young here in the UK, which is very much a zine. It's not Pitchfork, but it's cool. And they created it really just to celebrate the return of guitar bands. And they do kind of go back to, you know, the original guitar bands as well. I'm going to send you a record to them and see if they would be interested. Because I think that it's back. This sort of, you know, 4 or 5-piece guitar band. And it, again, celebrate with songs at the center of it, you know, just writing good songs.
Like when we first started playing shows and like started getting attention as a band in like 2008, it was like this reaction to like it was like us and I don't know, a few other bands like Best Coast kind of came around at the same time and like Waves, which we don't really sound like those bands, but it was like songs are back. Like it was like this funny, it was like, oh yeah, like people are like writing songs again and like guitars are back. Cause it was like a reaction to, I don't even know, like, it was like, I guess more like dancey, like early 2000s was like, you know, I don't know, or like Animal Collective was like kind of getting big, but I don't honestly know what the reaction was to, but it definitely felt like we rode some kind of wave, a very chill wave. People call us Chill Wave, even though like that then morphed into like a whole genre that we sound nothing like.
Yeah,
but I remember
it has to have a name or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. There was something about surfing a wave, but also creating part of it, which is where you get that lift from that gets an album in the US chart. You know, and that's how it happens. It's just being part of a cultural movement.
That's what I think is like, I didn't feel like we were doing anything particularly special or like innovative, you know, we're a 4-piece guitar band, you know, that's like, I was just writing like, I guess what I hope is that like, it was just cause the songs were good or people kind of like resonated with the songs, you know, to me, it's like these bands were just writing really good songs, you know, and maybe it was like being more comfortable with melodicism, you know, whereas I think, maybe that's what it was, to be honest, like more melodic music kind of became cool again. Whereas like, I think for a while it was cooler to kind of eschew that and kind of be it more experimental, you know, like it would probably be considered nerdy to be making music like we were making. And then all of a sudden people were like, wanted that, you know, we're like kind of missing that whatever Beatles-y thing.
Look, one of the things that I've talked to a lot of indie bands about on the art of longevity, because we kind of explore the downs as well as the ups, you know, in a career, because it is a roller coaster ride, is, you know, a lot of them have been through the ringer. They've been, you know, dropped several times over by labels and, you know, they've lost band members, which, you know, you definitely have had that experience. But you had this long and what seems to be a stable relationship with Domino, who've stuck with you and you've stuck with them. And that's a good thing. And it's a rare thing. What's that down to?
Signing a very long contract when you're 23 years old.
I mean, you know, I mean, plenty of people get thrown out of contracts, right? I mean, it's...
So, yeah. So, I mean, just to address the contract, it's like we put out one record and then it was like Domino's interested in us and like Sub Pop and like these really cool labels. So like, and then it was like Domino's interested in us and wants to put out like a bunch of albums. Like that sounded to me like all of a sudden I have like a future in music, you know, I have like a potential career here. So I was very, very excited about that and about the kind of like, and I kind of, I asked them about like, I was like, do you guys like, are we going to get dropped? You know, like they're like, we've never dropped a band or something. That's like what they said. Like,
yeah,
you know, and so there's that, but then, you know, I've seen that to not be the case. As the years have gone by, I've seen them drop bands. So for me, it's like, they're doing like from our end, like we really couldn't ask for a better label. Cause I mean, whatever the terms of the contract or whatever, like perhaps we've outgrown them at this point, but like we'll finish that at some point. And that's fine. That's just like us being kids and like signing a contract when you're young and not having proved ourselves at all. Like nobody knew, could have known where we would go. So that's all well and good. But having a label that is like willing to let us make records the way that we want to and never really questions us and never really like, you know, they're very supportive is what I'm saying. And they're very like, so that's great. And I guess from their end, we've never lost the money. We've always recouped, you know, our records. So like, that's probably all they need from us. You know, like, people seem to like our music and like, so we're not the Arctic Monkeys, you know, like we're not like one of their bigger bands, but we kind of like, we're just chugging along doing our thing and we're not losing anybody any money. And we're just
The numbers do set you free to some extent, but it makes perfect sense. That's the thing, right? So, I mean, in this day and age of bands being signed for a song on TikTok and what have you, and then being dropped, it's so crazy because what a label should do is stick with bands because, you know, they go through ups and downs creatively and commercially, but they end up making really good records again. Same thing happened with the Arctic Monkeys. They did have their moment where they were looking like they dropped off the edge of the cliff somewhat, and then they came back with A&M and, you know, the kids love them and they're, you know, they're back bigger than ever. But that's the thing, you wouldn't have maybe gotten to make this record, Daniel, in the way you've made it without that kind of long-term belief in each other. Possibly.
For sure. Me saying that the idea to work with Daniel Tashin came from the label, you know, they never, it's like all these things cost money. I guess, it's kind of nice to have a label that has an Arctic Monkeys and has like these bigger bands, like they're doing fine financially, I would assume. I don't really know, but I'm assuming like they've got the money to be like, sure, like if you want to. Yeah, I think they're doing all right. So it's like we're able to kind of benefit from that and be like, you know, we don't spend $1 million on our albums, but like we spend money on our records and like because it's like you have a number that's your advance and it's like we're not pocketing some money at the end of that. Like we usually kind of honestly spend more than what we're supposed to on our records, and they're totally down. They're very supportive and they help us out and they let us do what we feel like we need to do to make the best record we can. And I don't know, it's nice to have that. It's really nice. I mean, honestly, I hope that the relationship can continue, because I do feel like if we were on another label, I might find that I've been spoiled. You know, like I might find that like it might not be like that somewhere else.
Yeah, nothing wrong with being spoiled as an artist these days. If you can get it, take it. The Art of Longevity is recorded at Cube West Studios in Acton and sometimes at the Cube East Studios in London's Canary Wharf. Cube is the world's first members studio for musicians, podcasters and content creators, and it's a real sanctuary for London's independent, inspired creators. It's a real pleasure to record the show here. Martin, you sound happy. You sound like you're in a good place. I mean, 6 albums in now, 16 years. It feels like you've kind of crossed the Rubicon in a way, like real estate is going to continue until you decide not to continue. It's not like, I mean, even if the, you know, the relationship with Domino changed or whatever, or the record didn't do as well as you wanted, you'd make another record. You have enough fans, enough followers, enough momentum to keep on going. Does that make you feel good, confident about the future? How do you feel moving forward from now?
Well, I mean, to be honest, it hasn't really been easy. I do want to keep making records. Obviously, like my whole thing is like, I'll keep making albums until I die. And hopefully people will listen to them, like, because I just love writing music and recording. So, I mean, as long as I can go into a studio, so as long as somebody's willing to pay for that, I would, you know, and that's like my, when I say I've been spoiled, like I really, sometimes I realize like people don't just get to go to these studios and make records. Like, you know, like that's a huge thing that I have that's a big, I don't know what the word is. I'm very lucky in that regard, but yeah, I mean, it's tough. I've got little kids, you know, touring has become way harder for me. There's seemingly less money to be made. It's sometimes it feels like all signs are pointing to the fact that I should probably figure something else out, even though, and then I'm like, but things are doing so, you know, like, yeah, I mean, I could talk about this for a long time because it's what I think about all the time, to be honest. I am very conflicted, as happy as I sound. I'm very happy with the music we're making and I'm very happy with like what we've achieved. And yeah, and I guess I have high hopes for, I hope this record will do well. But I also kind of know that like there's a good chance it'll just come out and like it'll come and go like most things do.
Yeah. I mean, look, Bruce Springsteen puts out albums that just seem to disappear into the ether these days, right? It's happening to everybody.
Yeah, it is. But he can still pack stadiums.
Yeah. Look, I mean, and look, I mean, live is a really big factor in this equation, I think, because as you said right at the beginning of the conversation, that's getting harder.
Yeah, so that's it. I mean, I'm just hoping this tour does well. And but then again, you know, it's like, cool, the tour does well, so that means I got to tour some more. And like, it's tough, you know, with my family and my wife works. And so there's like, there's these logistical things where like, I, you know, yeah, it would be nice to all of a sudden make enough money from this band that my wife could quit her job. And then like, you know, like it's like, I hear you, you know what, yeah, I mean?
It's important to say it because, as I said, I didn't mean it to be like a flippant question because, yeah, I mean,
sure.
I think a lot of the bands that I've had on the show, especially, are in the same position. In fact, I mean, solo artists as well, they've had hits, they've had big albums that were written about, that were kind of celebrated as classics. They're on fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth albums. And, you know, not exactly touring in the five-star hotel, you know, rock and roll lifestyle that we all came to believe was the case.
You'd be surprised. Yeah.
So no, I absolutely get it. But I mean, to my mind with Daniel, when people hear it, I think they'll know it's special. I hope Domino sees it as special and that it can sort of take you back to a you know, a place you were certainly with Atlas or somewhere close to that.
They do. I mean, the labels, it seems like it's all these things. We're in a funny time right now. Like I said, 'cause the record's not out yet. The people that have heard it, like you and the people that I work with, it's hard to kind of judge from people that you work with because they're going to tell you
yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But I feel pretty strongly that it's a good record and you never know what's going to happen. But yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult to make a living as a musician. It's just hard these days. So, I mean, unless you're very successful, it's like just a middle class like struggle, you know?
Yeah, it's like running a small business. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, exactly.
Absolutely. I see it all the time and it's interesting, you know, you kind of see Instagrams of pretty well-known artists kind of, you know, packaging up their vinyl and putting the mailing sticker on and sending it out to fans. And I guess that's the industry we're in. And, you know, merch has become important. It's just important to just keep in touch with your fan base, I guess. I mean, I'm trying to get my hands on one of those 150 cassette tapes of Daniel that you've done.
Oh yeah. Well, I bet the label would just give you one. But yeah, I don't even know how that was like a Spotify thing. I want some too. I want to sell them.
It
on
was,
tour.
Yeah, it was a Spotify thing. It's really cool. It's I think that's that with all of that stuff coming back, I think it's great. I mean, at one point, didn't you have a shoe?
We did have a shoe. That was our friend. Our friend she has this company called Keeps. Yeah, so she did a shoe with like Animal Collective too. She's like a big music fan.
Right.
But yeah, we did that. I mean, we didn't have like a Nike signature whatever. It was a very small thing. But yeah, I mean, it's like we've done wines, beers, like there's like everyone wants to collaborate and you're like it's not like you're making money off of it. Like it's like no, that, yeah, it sounds
okay.
Great. Yeah.
Fair enough. No, but at the end of the day, you're a cool you know, you got to a place where you're probably a cool band and you could do do some cool stuff like that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not trying to, I didn't mean to like, I don't want to make this like any like dark or anything like that, but it is the reality. It's just like people, I think, expect that like, or maybe, I think maybe people do know now. It's like, and maybe I should say like, if you want like bands to keep going that you love, it's like buy a ticket to their show or like, but that's hard. You know, people don't have, people have lives. So it's like, or like buy a record. It's like, you got to support them directly. Cause it's like, it's pretty hard to make money, I guess. You know, there's fewer ways to do it. Buy a t-shirt from them or something.
Yeah. This is my hope. I mean, for bands that are established and coming to chat to me on this show is you spent those years making really good records and building up a community. And they're kind of the, you know, it's that fan community that you look to kind of say, hey, you know, keep buying the tickets, come to the show, spread the word, bring your friends, and, you know, reigniting their love for the band. So I'm hoping that happens for sure.
Yeah. And I'm also like, I really want to score, like I want to score like television or films and stuff. So I'm like,
oh,
maybe I can find
scores.
A way.
Yeah.
You
okay.
know, like, yeah. So I want to become like a film composer or something. That's like been my goal for a long time. But like, to me, like, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is like, I can find ways of continuing to do this band and continuing to do music that don't solely rely on, like, hopefully don't solely rely on like touring. And, you know, it's like, you got to kind of diversify your situation to keep it going.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that it'd be really great to see you do some original scores, and that's, hey, that's a growing business. Well, for now.
Yeah.
Well, Martin, look, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for the record. As I say, good luck with it and everything else. Hope to see you on the tour. And yeah, meanwhile, thanks for joining me on The Art of Longevity, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks so much. It was great to talk to you.
Cheers, Martin.
Bye.